Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Killett. Your host, Jimmy Akin, is our guest. We had a lovely extended conversation, if you can use that word, for a discussion about demons the first hour with Jimmy. And then at the end of the second hour, I said, go ahead and dial if you want to ask a question about demons. And I've rarely seen the lines just in sequence just light up one after another. But there is one, currently there's one line open. So if you've got a question about a demon or demons in general, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Again, I will emphasize, you don't have to be Christian to call. You don't have to be a believer of any kind, or you can be a practicing Catholic, whatever, anybody, the whole range. You're welcome to call if you've got a question about what the Catholics believe or understand about demons. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I got to invite you to our conference because it's getting down to the wire now. If you sign up now, you can still come. But September 25th through 28th, Jimmy Akin, our guest, he'll be one of our featured speakers. Chris Stefanik, who was on yesterday, is going to be our keynote speaker. Dr. David Anders will be there. I'd come just to meet Dr. David Anders. He's a wonderful guy. Dr. Amy Hamilton, who you have seen on various Catholic podcasts, talking about the sexual revolution mostly. Steve Dawson, the founder of St. Paul Street Evangelization. We'll do the radio show. We'll have all our apologists and all the usual fun. Just go to CatholicAnswersConference.com if you want to find out about it. Maybe come. CatholicAnswersConference.com. All right. Every line full now. So let's let people ask Jimmy their questions about... Oh, you know what? I'll tell you what. I do want to ask you something, Jimmy, and then I'll go to him. Mm-hmm. I forgot to ask you what's on the Jimmy Akin podcast this week. What dropped on Monday?
Well, this last Monday, it was on the Tetramorph. Oh, I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Finally, I mean, like, what? When is he going to get to the Tetramorph? I don't know. I can't remember what Tetra is. Is that more than a quadrimorph? Okay, if Tetramorph is a quadrimorph, then all right.
Yeah.
What is it?
Okay. Well, recall how last hour I mentioned that the cherubim that Ezekiel saw had four faces: that of a man, that of an ox, that of a lion, and that of an eagle. Well, that imagery has been used in Christian circles as a symbol for the gospel, for the four gospels, and there have been different ways of trying to estimate which animal symbol should be associated with which gospel. There is not just one way of doing this. There have actually been a bunch. And so this symbolism of the four faces of the cherubim being applied to the four gospels is known in Christian art as the tetramorph. Tetra meaning four and morphe meaning form or shape, so it's the four shapes or the four forms that are used to symbolize the gospels. And it goes back, this usage goes back to the late second century, but it's taken different forms or shapes down through Christian history. Different people have matched up these images to the gospels in different ways. So that's what I talk about in this episode.
I don't know that anybody else is doing that kind of work. Who else is talking about the Tetramorph on their Catholic podcast? Check it out on the Jimmy Akin.
And the Decepticons.
Oh, Tetramorph against the Decepticons. I'm going with Tetramorph myself in that battle.
Good bet.
Andrew's in Minnesota. Andrew, thank you so much. Thank you for starting us off. Go ahead with your question about demons for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is... I was curious to what degree, if any, you're familiar with the work of Dr. Michael S. Heiser, rest him, and the mnemonic nature of the Nephilim, and also connections to Mount Hermon and the gates of Hades and allusions to that in the Gospel of Matthew.
So I'm very familiar with Mike Heiser's work. I knew Mike when he was alive. Unfortunately, he passed on fairly recently, but yeah. I knew him. I've interviewed him. I've read multiple books of his, and I think he's performed a valuable service for people by retrieving some literature from the Second Temple period that had largely been forgotten in Christian circles. Like, you know, even though some people knew about the Book of Enoch and the Book of Jubilees, it was something that only people who were pretty arcane specialists really had an awareness of. And Mike did a really good job and a service to the Christian community by calling attention to this material as background information that can be helpful in reading not only Genesis, but also the New Testament. So I think he did a lot of good work. I think his work is incomplete, though, not just because of his unfortunate passing, but also because I think there was an aspect of the work that needs to be done that he didn't really address. And that was how to integrate these ancient views with what we know about the world now. So Mike would typically say, okay, so here's what the evidence indicates this text meant, but then he wouldn't say, and how should we understand that in light of what we know now? Like today we have a clearer awareness, like back when Genesis was written, they didn't have a clear awareness of the fact that angels don't really have physical bodies. That's a discovery that happened later in Christian history. And so it wouldn't have even been a question for the author of Genesis. Well, how could an angel mate with a human? Because they didn't view demons as non-corporeal the way we do. And so Mike did a good job in just saying, here's what this text means. But I think there's then a reception work of how do we receive and understand that to the extent we should, in terms of what we know today, in terms of later doctrinal development. And I think Mike didn't really do a lot of work in that area. And so I would say he did a good service in what he did, but I think his work is incomplete in that respect.
Okay.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah. And personally, as to his work on Reversing Hermann, I believe was the title of the book.
Yep.
Do you see any merit to the connections that he draws between the account as laid out in First Enoch or Enoch 1 and also in the Gospel of Matthew, for instance? Do you see there being...
There may be some intertextuality. There may be some textual references there, but I don't really have an opinion on that. And I think that the material described in these texts, like First Enoch, if it is to be given any credence at all, it's written from such a literary perspective that it needs to be heavily modified in order for there to be a modern reception of it. So this is one of the aspects of Mike's work that I think is unfortunate, in that he really doesn't get into this. But I think that if we were to have a modern reception of some of this material, we need to treat it as very, very non-literal. And Mike doesn't tend to explore that question.
Andrew, thank you very much. We're talking demons with Jimmy Akin. All the lines full at the moment. Terry's in Kansas, listening on 98.9 FM. Terry, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy and Si. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, how a Blessed Saint Benedict's medal has exorcist attributes?
Okay, well, Saint Benedict is someone that people have turned to for help regarding demons. You can't do a major exorcism, through Saint Benedict or his medal, but people have turned to Saint Benedict asking for help with demons, because wrestling with demons on the spiritual level was something Saint Benedict did during his own lifetime. And so it's been natural for people to say, hey, you know, please help me with struggles I'm having in this area. And in the course of time, it became a custom for people to use a medal of Saint Benedict, and there's even a blessing that's been authorized for not only members of the Benedictine community to give this medal, but for other priests as well, basically asking God to bless the medal and use it as an instrument in helping people avoid problems with demons. And so it's not that the medal itself has such properties. It's not like there's a magic that the medal has. This is all based on prayer. We're praying to God and asking for Saint Benedict's intercession to use the medal as a help in dealing with demons. And that's the sense in which there is efficacy here. It's not that the medal has this as one of its own properties. It's that we've asked God and Saint Benedict to help us out through the medal, and they can do that.
Terry, that brings us right to the break. I hope that that was a helpful answer to you. We'll be right back with more on demons with Jimmy Agin. At the moment, one line open, 888-318-7884.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
This is Jim Pinto, director of EWTN Media Missionaries. Mother Angelica said, "The essence of evangelization is to tell everybody Jesus loves you." You can help EWTN share the good news by becoming a media missionary. Visit EWTNmissionaries.com today and join us in sharing the eternal word with the world.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Agin, our guest this hour. As first hour, we had an extensive conversation about demons, who they are, what they are, what they do, how you can avoid them, all of that. This hour, we're open to your questions on demons, whether you are very knowledgeable about demons or not at all, whether you are a fully committed Christian or not religious at all. If you've got a question about demons, we'd love it if you'd call and ask. 888-318-7884. Going to upstate New York now, where Bryson is waiting. Bryson, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate your work, Jimmy. So my question was, the idea that, okay, the gods of the nations are demons or there's an idea proposed by later church fathers that the pagan gods of various places, like the Roman pagan gods or of various places, are demons. But it struck me that everything that was regarded as a god in every sort of polytheistic culture around the world is a demon. Might be that seems a little too simplistic on the face of it. So the question is, when looking at some sort of polytheistic or pagan religion from various places in the world, wherever it might be, looking at an entity or so-called God, what's a good way to determine, okay, this might actually be a demon, or it might be something else, or it might be nothing at all? Does that make sense?
Yeah, so I guess the first thing I'd say is we need to think through the conceptual space here in terms of what are the possibilities. Now, Deuteronomy provides an ancient Israelite perspective on the gods of the nations that they knew about. And it says they're demons. But there are other possibilities too. And we see, as an illustration of those, that emerged later in God's progressive revelation. So just because they have one conception at one period in God's revelation, that doesn't mean additional options won't open up later in God's revelation. And we actually see that starting to happen in the thought of St. Paul. In his thought, in 1 Corinthians, he does have the idea that foreign gods are demons, but he then parallels that with the statement that that an idol is also nothing, and that alludes to the option that you mentioned of maybe some of these gods are nothing at all, maybe they're just imaginary. And then there's also a possibility of maybe someone could be worshiping God, but under another name, and or you know, have some idea of God, of the true God, even though it's under another name. And St. Paul seems to allude to that in some of his statements, like in Acts 17, where he quotes from pagan sources and draws genuine spiritual insights out of them, like we are all his children and stuff. And he's quoting a pagan text that actually in its original context is referring to Zeus. So this would suggest that maybe the pagan author has a genuine spiritual insight about the relationship of divinity and humanity, and the pagan author is using the term Zeus to express that, Zeus being the highest of the Greek gods. And Paul is still picking up on this insight and applying it in a Christian sense. So we've sort of got three possibilities about what these pagan deities are. They could be the true God under another name. They could be nothing at all, or they could be demons. And I think it's too simplistic to just assume any one of those and say that explains everything. We have a much greater awareness of the diversity of human religious thought than the ancient Israelites did. They thought there were basically 70 people groups in the world, and they didn't even have a detailed knowledge of all of the beliefs of those 70 groups. Today, we have much more awareness of just how big humanity is and how great the diversity of belief is. And I agree with you. I find it hard to believe that for every single spirit that somebody somewhere has worshipped, that there is always a specific demon that corresponds to what these people believed, and in a one-to-one fashion, you know. So I think that there's a mix of phenomena going on here, consistent with the development of these different trajectories that we see in St. Paul's thought. My solution to your basic question, though, of how can we determine what's what in a particular case is, I would say that we can't for sure. I'm open to all of the possibilities in a particular case. Let's say I'm dealing with someone who is an Odinist, and they worship Odin. Odin might be totally imaginary, and no one in the spiritual world is picking up on the prayers that this Odinist is saying. But it also could be that some demon for the moment is impersonating Odin, and maybe at another time another demon will impersonate Odin. I wouldn't assume it's always the same demon all the way through history, or that there's any demon at any specific point. So I don't think there's a way to make a determination of, is a demon actually active here, apart from looking at the data that is generated in a particular case. If an Odinist, for example, starts doing preternatural things that cannot be explained by, psychology and natural causes, then I would be more inclined towards there's a demon who's answering his prayers to Odin if genuinely paranormal stuff is happening. On the other hand, if nothing paranormal is happening, I'd be more inclined to either there's not a demon here, or the demon isn't doing anything extraordinary, nothing more than common temptation. So I don't think there's a way to find a one-size-fits-all solution here. I think we have to be open to the different possibilities and not judge them prematurely, but in an evidence-based way.
Jonathan, thank you. Lots of folks on the line, so I'm going to keep going. We're talking demons today with Jimmy Akin. If you have a demon question, there's just one line open right now, 888-318-7884, going up to my town just up the coast now, Jonathan in Oceanside. Welcome, Jonathan. Go ahead with your question.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question is concerning earlier in the first hour, Jimmy mentions that there are three sources of temptation, the world, mm-hmm. the flesh, and the devil. My question is, can the devil or demons in general use the other two sources, the world and the flesh, to tempt us? Or are they separate and there's no overlap between the three sources?
Well, let's have Psy-Kellett answer this question for us. So Psy-Kellett, the question is, can the three sources of temptation overlap in some ways? Now, earlier you mentioned a desire of the flesh, or inbuilt disordered temptation for pizza, right?
Yes.
We also talked about another category of temptation, which is the world, or the example of others. Can you imagine situations where the example of others might combine with your own disordered desire for pizza in a way that would strengthen the desire for pizza and make it more likely you're going to give in?
Add a demon to that, and I think you've got a picture of my life right there, Jimmy.
Let's keep the demon out of it for
okay.
a minute.
All right.
Just to make the principles clear.
Yeah.
Could the example
of others lead
you to eat too much pizza based on your own desire?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
I mean, just think of that's the purpose of advertising, right? These categories can combine. And so in addition to the example of others, tempt inside, eat more pizza, like through advertising, or Ansi's own inbuilt desire to eat too much pizza, a demon could also be there whispering in his ear, hey, doesn't that pizza look good? Why don't you have some more?
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, these different categories can combine. But as I said before, since there's no way to pull them apart, the thing to do is not really worry and rigorously identify what's causing what. The thing to do is just trust God, ignore the temptation, and get on about your business.
Okay, Jonathan?
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thanks very much. That's why I can't watch the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, though. Just too much temptation involved there. Yeah, too much. Kate's in Bloomington, Indiana, listening on 89.9 FM. Glad to have you, Kate. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
My question is, could my son's father, who is now in his 50s, still be affected by what he did when he was in high school, which was he joined a satanic cult. He rebelled after getting kicked out of his Baptist school that he had been in since kindergarten. I think he was a junior. And when I met him in 2006, he told me the story, and I just kind of blew it off and didn't really realize how serious it was. And I'm a cradle Catholic, and basically, long story short, when our son was about 3, he just started acting really, really strange. And about a day after I blessed our home with blessed chalk over the doorway, he walked out on us, and there are many paranormal things that happened after that. And I still pray for him, and our son's a teenager now. And I just can't move on because I feel like he needs help, and there's no one there for him but me. Like, he needs an exorcism or something.
Jimmy?
And I just don't know what to do.
Okay. Jimmy?
Well, this is a sort of complex question, and so we're about to hit the hard break, and I don't want to give short shrift to this question. So, Kate, I'm going to defer the answer until the other side of the break so that I can do it justice.
Can you hang on through the break, Kate?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. Jimmy Akin is our guest. There's two lines open now. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. We had a very interesting hour talking about demons. You know, Jimmy's famous for applying faith and reason to these mysteries. And so we presented him, well, because Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is his podcast where he does that every week. But we presented him with the mystery of the demons and said, help us to figure out which things might be true about the demons, which things we don't know, and which things we do know about the demons. And this hour, we're opening the phones up to your calls. Whether you caught the first hour or not, and whatever you believe or don't believe, if you've got a demon question, we would love it if you'd pick up the phone and call. 888-318-7884. We are going to get to Kate's question when we get back, but we've got plenty of time to get to all the questions today. So go ahead and fill up those last two lines. 888-318-7884. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin Podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. That's not the devil's music. I don't know if there is devil's music. People have been calling since about Wagner. People have been saying that's the devil's music.
Earlier.
Even before Wagner? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that I believe in that, but we're talking about devils or demons today. If you've got demon questions, as I said, two lines open, 888-318-7884. However, we want to get to a quite serious question from Kate in Bloomington, Indiana, asking about her son's father, who got involved in satanic stuff when he was young and seems to still be affected by it in his 50s. Jimmy?
Okay, so the basic answer to the question of could there be some ongoing influence from what he did when he was in high school is, well, sure. All kinds of things are possible. I mean, if you got a young guy in high school with a pink carnation in a pickup truck and he gets drunk and goes out driving, he may flip the truck and injure himself in a way that's going to haunt him for the rest of his life. So, you know, injuries and things that were received in high school can still have effects later in life. And, you know, so obviously, if he did join a satanic cult, that could have affected him either by causing some kind of damage to him or by attracting the attention of demons to him in a way that they're still taking an interest in him and still messing with him, or both. My question, though, since this is over a period of 30 years later, would be what evidence is there that that's the case? Because just because something's possible doesn't mean it's likely. And there are lots of people who have, you know, minor flirtations with Satanism when they're young, and then they get over it and they grow up and it doesn't have any lingering effects like that. So in trying to evaluate a particular case, what the church does and what paranormal investigators do is they make a list of all of the possible explanations for the observed phenomena, and then they go down the list and see if there is a natural cause for these phenomena. And only if there is no natural cause is one warranted in proposing that there is a paranormal cause. So in the case of your former husband, or perhaps current legal husband, you said that he started acting weird at a certain point a number of years ago. And, well, that could be because of demons, but it could also be because he was developing a kind of mental illness. You said he left at a certain point, and, well, that could be because of demons, or it could be because there were other stresses in the marriage at the time that were purely natural. So in terms of early things like that, you know, I don't know the situation, but I'm not hearing anything that demands the demonic as an interpretation. And so without something that demands the demonic as an interpretation, I'm going to do what the church would do, which is fall back on normal, natural causes for these things. Also, if, you know, your husband had, for example, at some point after his involvement with this group, if he had become a practicing Christian and, you know, repented of his involvement in this group, that's something that would be evidence against ongoing demonic activity. The thing that you said that I found most interesting was that after he left, there have been ongoing multiple paranormal events. Okay, if that's the case, then it's possible that they could be produced by demons. It's also possible that if they're genuinely paranormal, they're being produced by something other than demons. Or it could be that they're not actually paranormal. They just appear to be, but they have purely natural causes. This is something that paranormal investigators learn, is that when you're investigating, let's say someone thinks they've got a ghost in their house, even when the evidence is that they have a ghost in their house, there's probably other stuff that is being misinterpreted as ghostly activity that's purely normal. Because once people have the idea that I've got a ghost in my house, they start interpreting everything through that lens. So every bump in the night becomes, oh, there's that ghost again, when really it's just a bubble in your water pipes or something. And the same thing can happen in this kind of situation where one becomes concerned that my husband or former husband is being affected by demons, and then everything that happens surrounding him gets analyzed through the lens of, oh, here's something strange that happened, I bet that's demons again, when in fact it may not be. So, and this is part of why the church requires exorcists to carefully look into a case and say, are these phenomena something that is better explained by medical conditions or by psychological conditions? Because normal phenomena, like medical problems and psychological problems, are more common than paranormal phenomena like demons. So if if normal causes can explain the reported phenomena, then they should be understood in that light. It's only if the reported phenomena go beyond what nature could itself result in that we're warranted in talking in proposing a demon as the explanation, among other paranormal causes like angels or ghosts or other things. So, you know, I just don't know enough about the case to offer an opinion one way or the other about what's going on here. But I would say, just like the church would not automatically jump to the demon explanation, that there are other possible explanations, and we shouldn't just jump to the demon explanation either. In terms of what could be going on with him, well, it's like I said, it's possible that there's residual damage or interest from when he was in a satanic cult, but it's also possible there aren't, that there isn't, that the problems he may be experiencing now are due to other factors, you know, genetics, environment, free will, all those kind of things. If you're concerned for him, which you obviously are, and that's a praiseworthy thing, there are things you can do. Obviously, you can continue to pray for him. Hypothetically, you could talk to him about these things that are going on, whatever they may be. You could also see if he'd be interested in getting some counseling, perhaps from a Catholic priest, perhaps even from an exorcist. He might be open to that. You know, if an exorcist were to determine that there is likely demonic activity here, then the exorcist could perform an exorcism, and he could even perform an exorcism from a distance, because exorcists don't have to be physically present with the person to perform an exorcism. So hypothetically, he could be exorcised from a distance. There are also things less than exorcism that a person can do if it's less clear that a demon is involved and that a full exorcism is warranted. Like, there are what are known as deliverance prayers that you and others could say for him to help him out, even if this isn't a full-blown case of possession. So there are things you can do, and I want to encourage you in that regard, but I also want to just caution you that we shouldn't be quick to assume it's a demon when it might in fact be something else.
And Kate, I will leave it there because there are quite a few still on the line ready to talk about demons. I hope that was helpful to you. Off to Oklahoma we go. AJ is in Oklahoma. Go ahead with your question, AJ, for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for taking my call. I just wondered why Padre Pio was, I guess the word would be, oppressed by the devil since he was a saint, received the Eucharist every day, prayed 15 rosaries a day.
Well, so I assume that what you're referring to is my comments earlier about how demons don't like the holy. And that's true. They don't. That's, in fact, one of the diagnostic criteria the church uses to diagnose demonic possession, is the fact that the alternate personality has a notable aversion to the holy. So it's a reasonable question. Why would demons go after someone who is notably holy? Well, it might not be the kind of thing that they would normally do because they don't like holiness. But just like some people enjoy a challenge, some demons would seem to enjoy a challenge. It's like the bigger they are, the harder they fall. So if you can take down someone who is really noticeably holy, you're going to get more points from and more street cred from your fellow demons. They're going to respect you more. And so I would imagine that just like there are humans who climb mountains precisely because climbing the mountain is hard, that there are demons who would want to conquer Mount Padre Pio, if at all possible, just precisely because it's hard. And they know it's going to be harder on them because of how holy he is. But I would suspect there are at least a few demons who are attracted by saying, hey, let's see if we can corrupt this potential future saint. And that's the kind of challenge that stimulates them and that they get off on. So that would be my explanation. It's not what most demons do. It's not the way they normally act. But the history of some saints, not all, but some saints reporting things like demonic attacks would suggest that at least some demons are interested in that. either as a way, either because they enjoy the challenge or because they want to ruin the good that the saint could otherwise do if they weren't attacking him, or things like that.
What do you think, AJ?
Thank you.
Oh, very good. Well, thank you. You brought us right to the break. We'll come back with more questions on demons for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1996. EWTN launches EWTN.com, one of the first Catholic websites in the world. In the late 1990s, it becomes one of the first entities in the world to do video streaming over the internet.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Jimmy Akin, our guest. Demons, our topic. Lots and lots of calls, but I'll tell you what, we've got a couple lines open now, so if you want to get in, if you've got a question about demons, whatever your own beliefs are, if you've got a question about what Catholics believe about demons, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. We'd love talking to you. It doesn't really, you don't say, oh, but I don't think they want to talk to me. They want to talk to Catholics. No, anybody, you can call 888-318-7884. If you've got a demon question, pick up that phone. Karen is in Portland, Oregon, listening on the great modern day Catholic radio. Glad to have you here, Karen. Go ahead with your question.
My question is with regards to Jimmy's comment about the fact that Genesis 6 ought to be taken in a largely symbolic way. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if, Jimmy, you were familiar with the work of Timothy Alberino, and I was hoping you would be because I wanted to ask your opinion about it.
What specifically did you want to ask my opinion about?
And try speaking right into the phone. Well, having trouble hearing you. So as clear as you can,
okay.
Right into the phone.
Here, let me take you off.
Yeah, that's just advice for the audience. Never use speakerphone when you're talking to a radio show. It always causes problems.
Sorry.
It's all right.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, we got you nice and clear now. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Okay. So Timothy Alberino holds that the Genesis 6 is literal and that it's all explained in the book of Enoch and that the angels mentioned there are not angels as Aquinas describes them, that they are something more like a hybrid, and that when they copulated with the sons of, or daughters of men, they produced the giants. And he said there's, he's an archaeologist, and he's gone all over the world and uncovered tons of evidence, apparently, that confirms this. And I was just wondering if you were familiar with his work and what your opinion of it was.
Okay, so I know the name, Timothy Alberino. His website advertises him as an author, researcher, and explorer, but as far as I can tell, he does not claim to have any kind of degree in archaeology. So I don't think he's an actual archaeologist. Now, there is a relationship between Genesis 6 and the Book of Enoch. The Book of Enoch was written in the Second Temple period, so well after the Book of Genesis was written, and it is based on material that is reflected in the Book of Genesis. There are also several other books that were written in this period that are also related to what's in Genesis 6, but at least based on what you said, if he wants to claim that this event was literal and there literally were angelic beings who mated with humans and produced giants, I would want to say, well, what's your evidence for that? I mean, I know what the texts say, but, you know, where are the bones? What DNA can we look at? Where, you know, if you want to say this was all a physical event, I want to know what evidence you have that this was all a physical event. And I'm not familiar with any good evidence to that point. So I would be very skeptical of what Timothy Alberino claims, if that's what he actually claims. There is a big risk of people who are operating in a kind of fringe area like this, who are not really careful scholars, which is what I'm trying to be, but who are sensationalistic and are trying to propose and explore ideas precisely because they sound dramatic, and they try to inflate the evidence for things when really there isn't strong evidence here. So I think the golden mean is one, meaning the balanced approach, is one that is open-minded and evidence-based, that neither is totally dismissive nor overly credulous, overly easy to believe sensationalistic claims. And so I would say that based on my reading of the evidence, you know, I think that people like this have some genuine insights into what the text means that actually previous and better scholars have formulated that they're now copying. But I am unaware of any good evidence that would support the idea of this being a literal physical event, though I'm open-minded. You know, if they could produce such evidence, I'm open to hearing it. I just haven't seen any good evidence of that.
Karen, thank you very much for the call and for the question. On we go, trying to get everybody on with Jimmy before the end of the hour. Alyssa is in Central Texas, listening on Armor of God Radio. We're so happy to have you. Alyssa, go ahead with your question.
Hi, thanks. I have a sort of a speculative question here. I know Elon Musk, one of his many pet projects, he wants to upload human consciousness to a digital state or electronic state, and thereby make it eternal. He's already done this with
Alyssa, have you heard Elon Musk say that exactly? Or are you just aware of him doing a Neuralink interface to enable, for example, disabled people to express themselves
through
it?
That's the practical application of the end goal he has. I think his end goal is very unlikely. But
yeah,
Alyssa,
hang on. So I can't vouch for that. So I'm going to assume that what you're saying is true, or that I know there are people who do want to upload human consciousness to a computer system. I don't know that Elon Musk is one of them. But there are such people, so let's assume that one such person, whether it's Elon Musk or someone else, tries to do that and claims that they have. I would agree with you that it's very unlikely that they would be able to do that. In fact, I would say it's impossible for them to do that. But let's suppose they did. What's your question?
So supposing this technology did happen, could such a uploaded consciousness be afflicted by the demonic the way embodied humans are, and how would a priest go about exercising such a person when they don't really have a traditional body?
Okay, well, in regard to the first question, now, like I said, I think this is impossible, but supposing it were not impossible, if human consciousness was uploaded to a computer system, would demons still have the ability to affect it? Well, we see evidence in Scripture that both angels and demons are able to affect physical systems. And so the computer that the consciousness was operating on is a physical system, so both angels and demons would be able to affect it. So having a body is not necessary for demons to be able to affect you. So yeah, they could continue to affect it. How would an exorcist be able to help this person, assuming that they were being afflicted by this demon? Well, you don't need a body in order to do an exorcism. Like I mentioned earlier, you can do exorcisms at a distance. Now, there are certain things you can't do at a distance, like you can't anoint the possessed person with holy oil. You can't, sprinkle holy water on them. You can't offer them a cross to hold or impose a cross on their forehead or something like that. But you can say all the prayers. You can say the prayers asking God to help the person. You can say the prayers commanding the demon to get out in the name of Jesus. You can do all that. And so the exorcist would simply use the parts of the rite that can be done with respect to the demon-afflicted person in the computer. And in fact, he might even be able to go further. Like even if he can't impose a cross on the person's forehead, he could take the cross and impose it on the computer and see if that has an effect. So God's power is unlimited, and therefore there are still ways for God to help someone, even if they're counterfactually in a computer system and being attacked by a demon. God can help you no matter where you are.
We're getting near the end, so I want to get everybody on. Alyssa, thank you very much for the call. Anna is in Pennsylvania. Anna, if you can be a bit quick with your question, it would help us out a great deal.
Yes, hi, thank you. Sure. So I am actually Protestant, but I take the teachings of the Catholic Church under serious advisement, especially on certain matters. And I was wondering if the church has a definite teaching one way or the other on the existence or non-existence of ghosts. And I ask that because I do believe in ghosts, but I'm also very skeptical as to what exactly ghosts are. And mm-hmm. I assume that some of the time, or maybe even all of the time, there are demons posing as ghosts. So can you tell us what the church has to say about that, if anything?
Yeah, so this isn't strictly a matter of church. Well, it depends on how you define ghost. Strictly speaking, the church teaches that ghosts exist because ghost is just another word for spirit. And the church does teach that spirits exist. That's why, that the Holy Spirit is sometimes referred to as the Holy Ghost. And he obviously exists. He's one of the three persons of the Trinity. Angels and demons are spirits, so they can be called ghosts. Humans have spirits that survive our deaths, so we have ghosts. So strictly speaking, the church does teach the existence of spirits or ghosts. Most people, when they use the term ghost, though, are referring to a human spirit that is manifest in after their bodily death. And that is, in fact, the traditional Catholic understanding of what ghosts are, that they are human spirits manifesting after the person's bodily death, very often while they're in the process of purification on their way to heaven. And such ghosts frequently are trying to, for example, tie up bits of business they have left over from life, or they ask for prayers to help them on their journey to heaven or things like that. And the way later theology would express that is these are souls from purgatory who are still being purified on their way to heaven, and they're asking for help from the living. And that was the Catholic understanding of ghosts, not the same as church teaching, but the common Catholic opinion on what ghosts were down to the time of the Reformation and since then. It was in the Protestant community that this idea of we need to suspect demons as impersonating ghosts really got started. Demons can impersonate ghosts. They can even impersonate angels. But it's always a question of what's the evidence that we have for this. If a ghost is showing up and saying, hey, will you please pray for me? That doesn't sound like a demon. That sounds like, someone who is oriented towards God and wants your help reaching God, as opposed to if they show up and a spirit says, hey, why don't you worship me? Well, I'd say that's a demon. So I would say we need to think carefully about what the evidence we have is in a particular case, and we shouldn't just assume that a spirit that's appearing is a demon. In fact, spirit appearances after someone's death is extraordinarily common. In parapsychology, these are known as after-death communications, or ADCs, and between 40 and 50% of the population reports having their dead loved ones appear to them at least once during their lives. And it's hard to think that all of that is due to demons rather than people genuinely being allowed an experience of their departed loved ones by God. If you're interested for more information on this, I've got some episodes of Mysterious World where I deal with this. In particular, you might want to check out, you can go to youtube.com/Jimmy Akin and search on ghosts, but also in particular, look up episodes. Let me see if I can get the episode numbers quickly enough. Episodes 306 and 307 on after-death communications. And I hope that helps.
I do too, Anna. Thank you very much. We got to almost everybody, but the calls kept coming. I guess people are very interested in the topic of demons. Certainly interested in talking with you, Jimmy. Thanks for doing the 2 hours with us.
My pleasure.
And that will do it for us. As we said, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops each Friday. A new Jimmy Akin podcast drops each Monday, where he tackles the mysteries of the faith. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.